Today, Governor Bruce Rauner delivers his State of the State address. That comes as the Senate has finally put forward plans for a bipartisan budget deal. Here's Senate President Democrat John Cullerton.
We're going to fight this forever. We're going to never solve any problems in the state.
We'll talk about that and what we can expect to hear from Governor Rauner later today. And we have the United Way and one school superintendent give us their own state of the state analysis about how social service agencies and K-12 education is faring. Also, all this week, we've been talking about how the Trump administration will affect Illinois' economy. Today, healthcare. Here's Senator Durbin speaking on the Senate floor yesterday.
Repealing Obamacare and then talking about the possibility of replacement is a disaster. It is an invitation to uncertainty and chaos.
If Obamacare was repealed, what would that mean for the million people in Illinois who receive coverage? What would you like to see happen? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21st Show. That's all coming up this hour, but first, the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There's lots of news going on today, both in Washington and Springfield. Within an hour, we'll be hearing from Governor Bruce Rauner, who will deliver his third State of the State address. It comes, of course, as the two-year-long budget impasse continues between Rauner and the Democratic state legislature. But first, we've been talking this week about how policy changes proposed in Washington by the Trump administration may affect Illinois. We've talked about agriculture and manufacturing. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at science. In every conversation we've had so far this week, one topic keeps coming up, that's health care. This past weekend, President Trump issued an executive order, a one-page document describing his intent to repeal the Affordable Care Act. What would a repeal mean for the 1 million people in Illinois who've been able to receive coverage, whether that's through the marketplace or the expansion of Medicaid? How would jobs in health care be affected? This week, we've already seen our Republican Governor Bruce Rauner take an unexpectedly public position on the issue in a form of a letter his insurance chief sent to Washington, asking that Obamacare not be repealed without a replacement. It's not often that he and Illinois senior senator, Democratic Dick Durbin, agree. But here's Durbin speaking on the Senate floor yesterday.
We've asked Republicans, what would you replace Obamacare with? And until some of the most recent moments, there was never an answer. Now they are starting to put at least some ideas forward. But I will tell you, repealing Obamacare and then talking about the possibility of replacement is a disaster. It is an invitation to uncertainty and chaos.
That's Senator Dick Durbin yesterday on the Senate floor. By the way, there's actually less than 1 week left for open enrollment for Obamacare for 2017. I imagine that might have escaped people's notice given all the conversation we're having over the policy itself. To talk about all of this, we've invited two healthcare experts to join us for a discussion about all of these issues. On the line with us from Chicago, Stephanie Becker is a senior policy analyst at the Sargent Shriver Center on Poverty Law. Larry Boris is the CEO of the nonprofit Midwest Business Group on Health. Larry, Stephanie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And for those of you listening, we would love to hear from you. What do you think should happen with the Affordable Care Act? What do you want lawmakers to do? Do you have questions about possible changes? You can tweet us. Our handle is 21st Show. That's 21ST Show. You can call us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. Larry, your nonprofit represents a wide variety of employers. What are you hearing for your members? I know that you represent your business group. You represent medium to large self-insured public and private employers. What are you hearing from your folks about the idea of repealing ACA?
Well, clearly the employers favor portions of the ACA being repealed. The ACA places a variety of financial and reporting burdens on employers, proposes penalties for having rich benefits, and a number of things that don't bring any value back to employers, but are costing them hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to comply with. So those are the key areas that they're looking at. There are areas of the ACA that they do favor, and we can talk about that later.
Mm-hmm. And Stephanie, this is also actually, all of this policy discussion is happening as the last week of open enrollment is, we are in the middle of that for 2017 coverage. Stephanie, are you seeing a lot of people signing up?
Yeah, we actually are. We're in line with where we were last year for 2016 enrollment. We're in line for 2017. Last year, just as a reminder, we had about 335,000 people end up signing up for the marketplace. And so far, CMS reports that as of last week, we've had about 350,000 people sign up for the marketplace. So this shows a real indication that people want and need coverage, which is strong despite the political climate. You know, people definitely still need this coverage and are clamoring to get it.
And I imagine some people, Larry, I imagine people who haven't signed up for 2017 coverage might be wondering, what will happen if I sign up and then Obamacare gets repealed? Larry, is this something that would happen right away?
I can't believe it would happen right away because we have nationwide, I think, over 20 million people who are covered through their additional service through the exchanges, as well as the expansion of Medicaid. And over 80% of those people, I believe, are on some level of subsidy to enable them to afford the high premiums that are on the plans. So you can't just pull that out. There has to be some way of transitioning and supporting those people. Otherwise, it's like repealing Medicare. You know, what would you do to replace it? You can't do it overnight. There's just too many people who rely on it for their livelihood, their coverage, and for them and their families.
And Stephanie, just to be clear, to underscore what Larry's saying, this is a contract, right? Insurers are required to cover you, I imagine, for the full year?
That's right. When you sign up for a plan on the marketplace, you are and you pay your first month's premium, that is a contract between you and the insurer for 2017 coverage. So as Larry said, something significant would have to happen for the insurers to stop that contract.
Larry, to your opinion, do you think it's possible? I mean, we keep talking about this whole notion of repeal of Obamacare, and there's all these different portions of it, and we'll get into that in a minute. But is it possible, you think, even to have just a straight full repeal of Obamacare?
No, there's too many parts of it. It is not just the public exchanges or marketplace. It really affects both the way insurance has been reformed, the coverages, it affects the way we pay and deliver health care. There's a lot of elements, and so a total repeal without looking carefully at each of the provisions is really a disaster in the works.
And Stephanie, that's something you also would oppose. Can you explain why you think this would be a disaster?
Sure. So right now, if the ACA were repealed, 30 million people would lose coverage. In Illinois alone, 1.2 million people would lose coverage. And then all the other things, the protections, like Larry mentioned, that go along with it would start to unravel. So the pre-existing condition protections, the policy to keep kids up until age 26 on their parents' plans, the essential health benefits like mental health benefits and care like habilitative care to help people recover from illnesses, those would all go away if there was a full repeal. And at this point, there's no appetite by either party at this point to get rid of those protections. So the challenge, of course, is how do you keep the protections that everyone likes, but then keep the promise of repealing the ACA, which President Trump and the congressional leaders have said they wanted to do.
Right. You mentioned congressional leaders. We played part of Senator Durbin, just a little clip of it. And I want to play a larger portion of it. I know that he and Senator Duckworth, they sent letters to every hospital in Illinois and asked them about what the impact of repealing ACA would be. And here are his thoughts on what would happen in Illinois if Obamacare was repealed and not replaced.
90,000 young people in Illinois would be thrown off their parents' health plans. More than 7 million Illinoisans with health insurance through their employer would once again be subject to discriminatory health insurance practices like discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, annual and lifetime caps on coverage, and discrimination against women. In my state, the Republican repeal plan would have an impact statewide because insurance plans statewide could once again decide not to cover maternity or newborn care, mental health, or substance abuse. Those things are required under the Affordable Care Act. That would be removed with its repeal. In my state, more than 1 million people would lose their health insurance. In fact, 1.2 million to be exact. And according to the Illinois Hospital Association, My state would lose $11 to $13 billion in annual economic activity with Republican repeal, translating to the loss of up to 95,000 jobs. And let me tell you about those jobs. In towns like Taylorville and Pena, Illinois, near my hometown of Springfield, those are good-paying jobs. Sometimes they're the best-paying jobs in the community.
That's Democratic Senator Dick Durbin on the Senate floor yesterday, and I would love to hear from both of you, my guests who are on the line with me, Stephanie Becker, who's a senior policy analyst with the Chicago-based Sargent Shriver Center on Poverty Law, Larry Boris, CEO of the Chicago-based nonprofit Midwest Business Group on Health. Larry, can I start with you? Your thoughts on what Senator Durbin said about employers no longer being required to offer insurance coverage to their employees. Is that what you would expect?
Well, I think there's a general fallacy that employers were offering benefits as an altruistic approach. I think at the end of the day, we have done surveys of employers locally and nationally, and employers offer health care to recruit and retain talent. So it doesn't matter whether you're Chase Bank or your Joe's Print Shop. If you don't offer health care coverage, you could potentially lose your people to another employer or another truck service. You could not have healthy and productive employees. You would not attract new people as well. So if the ACA was removed, yes, there wouldn't be a requirement that people, that employers offer coverage. But in the reality of the situation is virtually 90% plus of all employers, regardless of their size, offer some level of coverage. Very small ones clearly do not, but many even give employees a certain amount of money to buy coverage. So I don't see that as a realistic outcome. Clearly some small employers might, but there's a development related to exchange, but not related to the ACA but not attached to it, called private health insurance exchanges that have been created since 2012 for small as well as very jumbo employers that offer similar kind of benefits on a group basis and not on an individual basis, which would make these things available for employers, whether the ACA was there or not.
Okay. Stephanie, Senator Durbin also mentioned a few things we hear a lot about in discussions. You mentioned this, and we've heard this from lots of people about young people not being able to stay on their parents' plans, people not being able to get coverage for pre-existing condition. What was surprising to me, no requirement to cover maternity care without replacement. Are you seeing that as a reality?
Yes. So that was one of the main things that maybe a lot of people don't know about, but the Affordable Care Act did set these essential health benefits, and what you just mentioned are those. And without a mandate to cover comprehensive health care, they could go away. For example, 650,000 people in Illinois get health care through the Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid programs have to cover those essential health benefits, just like the private health insurance plans. So without that mandate, it's possible that people who work for large employers, may not see those going away as much. But for certain low-income people, people in poverty, people who are taking advantage of the subsidies in the marketplace and the Medicaid expansion could see those protections going away immediately.
When you talk about subsidies, I also know that the costs of this, what critics say, there are a lot of people who aren't eligible for those subsidies. And I'm thinking in particular, Stephanie, of a farmer that we had on the program this past Monday who talked about the concern over rising health care costs and just the ability to afford it. Here's Paul Taylor.
Our costs in 2017 will be $2,200 a month with $6,000 each deductible. How do we fix it? I'm not sure. I just know that there's real issues. I think it's stymieing independent small farmers, folks that don't have opportunities to get insurance through perhaps a spouse's employment or off-farm employment or Medicare. And it's tough on the small business people in rural communities that try to run a machine shop, a painting business, other things, and have $20,000 a year of health care costs.
That's Paul Taylor, a farmer in northern Illinois. As I was saying, they didn't qualify for subsidies, but it was obviously the affording paying $20,000 a year in healthcare costs, something really tough for them. Stephanie, I wonder if you could start just response to that. I mean, how many, if you're hearing common complaints from people under Obamacare, certainly this is what we've seen with critics that it's just too expensive for a lot of people.
Yeah, I think we all can agree that there are improvements that the ACA should make, and even President Obama on his way out was saying that he would agree to improvements to the plan. So I hear what Paul is saying about expensive deductibles and expensive premiums, and that's what, you know, around the country people have said. However, I think we need to keep what we have and build on some improvements. And to that, I would say we need deeper subsidies for the plan, so that to help subsidize people above 400% of the federal poverty level, to make it so working folks are able to afford it.
Right. I mean, Stephanie, but do you think deeper subsidies are a possibility when what we're hearing right now from the Trump administration is they don't even want ACA at all?
I haven't heard that as a possible solution to the plan, but I haven't heard any workable solution that would get to the affordability of health insurance while also maintaining plans that aren't skimpy.
Yeah, Larry, we just have really quickly before the break, what's your thoughts on costs, Larry?
Okay, I would say initially it's important to recognize that costs were high before the ACA. And it wasn't the ACA that drove the cost up. Insurance premiums are high because, first of all, under the ACA, everyone was supposed to be covered, but everyone was supposed to pay for insurance. But what's happened is you have not had healthy people getting coverage. And prior to ACA, the health insurance plans could charge higher for people who had pre-existing and other conditions, and lower for others, so it was a large insurance pool. So that's a major part. Mm. Also, we have...
Let me stop you there, Larry. I'm just going to stop you there because we're going to have to take a break, but you can finish that thought in just a minute. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. If, by the way, those of you listening, if you have questions or comments about this, give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21st Show. We got a couple questions via email that we'll get to after the break as well, but if you want to give us a call, that's 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about health care in Illinois and what changes we might expect from the Trump administration. My guests are Stephanie Becker on the line from Chicago, where she's with the Sargent Shriver Center on Poverty Law. Larry Boris is president and CEO of the nonprofit Midwest Business Group on Health. Larry, I just wanted you to be able to finish your thought, because we were talking about costs, and you were saying, as lots of critics, of course, everyone's saying the costs are too high for folks. I just wanted you to be able to finish that thought.
Thanks very much. So as I said, you know, when you look at the originally insurance approach, it's that you have a broad pool of people, healthy and sick, and so nobody has to pay an increasing amount, or you end up having to pay for the services you require. Also, that you wouldn't pay for first dollar services, like in car insurance, you don't pay for insurance doesn't cover oil changes and things like that. It's basic maintenance. However, ACA changed all that, required a very full package of benefits, and did not have everyone covered. We also have a high cost in our drugs and our services, and tremendous variation in quality and cost. We have an aging population. We have greater use of technology. We have overutilization of services. Once people have insurance, they tend to take advantage of it. They go to emergency rooms for non-emergency situations. We have people demanding care that they actually don't need, or drugs because of what they see on TV. And we have doctors and other providers offering services that they think is appropriate but may not meet the patient's need, but they do it for malpractice reasons. We have poor lifestyle choices, people not eating correctly, not getting exercises, and we have an increasing number of people with chronic disease and at a young muncher stage. All of this is not impacted by the private, the public marketplace.
Yeah, there's a lot of issues there. So, yeah, Larry, I wanted to ask you,
healthcare will continue.
Wait, when you talk about that, there have been changes we've seen in terms of the way hospitals operate since Obamacare was mm-hmm. implemented. What have hospitals been doing? How have you seen healthcare costs reduced?
Sure. So this is what I was mentioning earlier, that the ACA is more than just providing coverage to people. I see it in three chapters. It was providing coverage through the exchanges and Medicaid expansion. Chapter two was reforming the health insurance industry and coverage. But it's chapter three, where we're changing the way we pay for and deliver and look at health care. So hospitals, physicians, the whole health system is now required to do greater transparency on cost and quality and performance. There's new delivery models like accountable care organizations and medical homes. There's new payment approaches like bundled payments, incentives for quality, penalties for the hospitals that have a high infection rate, bundled payment, a variety of things that really will impact and improve quality and cost. And those are all part of the ACA, or at least were, I should say, given an extra engine because they did begin with this. And Medicare is now a leading entity, as well as in some states and even part of Illinois, the Medicaid, where they're driving really improvements. And a lot of this motivation wouldn't have taken place without the ACA initially. Though I think even if you were repeal the ACA, a lot of this will continue. The train's left the station on quality, cost, and waste in the system.
Stephanie, Larry mentioned Medicaid. We got an email from the Champaign County ACLU saying they're concerned about children in foster care and people with disabilities because both of those groups have benefited from expanded eligibility via Medicaid that Illinois opted in for. What do you think would happen in Illinois, Stephanie? Is that something that the state could agree to continue to do? You know, we've heard some discussions about states continuing to opt in.
Yeah, so it's a really good question, and it's a really uncertain time right now, I would say, because those are part of the Medicaid expansion population, and not only is the expansion at risk because of ACA repeal, but Medicaid itself is at risk because of proposals by President Trump and congressional leaders to block grant Medicaid, which basically is a way to say cuts to Medicaid. So cuts to eligibility, including potentially foster children up to age 26, and cuts for financing. So I think it remains to be seen what's going to happen, but we have to be very vigilant about these populations and what it means for vulnerable populations.
We've been asking you what you think about ACA, about the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, how you would be impacted if it was repealed. We've got a caller from Champaign. Hey, Lance, welcome to the 21st. You're a small business owner. What are your thoughts?
Hi there. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. As a small business owner for 16 years, I've seen health care costs go up an average of 20 to 25% a year. This was my second year purchasing healthcare from the shop marketplace. And I don't know if a lot of business owners actually do that because most business owners I talk to hate the whole idea of Obamacare. They don't want to go anywhere near it. And so my second year buying from shop marketplace actually lowered my cost. Not a lot. I mean, a small percentage. But it's the first time I have ever seen my healthcare costs go down. Just a percent or two, but, you know, I mean, that's big because it's been going up 20, 25% a year.
Wow. So for you, it sounds like you wouldn't want anything to change right now.
No, not at all. In fact, one of the issues with the Affordable Care Act is just the huge resistance against it. If people would actually work together and actually fix it, I mean, this is, you know, healthcare is an incredible burden on small business owners, especially the ones who try to offer good plans to their employees so that they can keep good employees. And, you know, again, this is my year two buying the exact same plan from Blue Cross Blue Shield, and my costs actually went down. I'd love to see 3-4 years from now, if Obamacare is improved instead of repealed, could those health care costs go down even more?
Interesting. Yeah, Lance, thanks so much. Thanks for that call. Thanks for the comment. Of course, there's always more we could talk about with this, but unfortunately, we're out of time for this. So I want to thank Lance for calling, Stephanie Becker with the Sergeant Shriver Center on Poverty Law, Larry Boris as well with the Midwest Business Group on Health. We've tweeted out more details about this, by the way. If you follow 21st Show, 21ST Show, you can see all the different reports that we were just talking about. Stephanie, Larry, thanks for being with me.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the 21st. Today, Governor Rauner delivers his third State of the State address. And where are we as a state? Well, for the past 2 years, we've been without a budget. Limited stopgap funding for higher education, social service agencies, other institutions like correctional facilities. That stopped as of the first of this year. And what happened last year? Well, we lost more residents than any other state in the union. Our state's credit ratings have been cut five times under Governor Rauner. Most recently, Fitch warned that the failure to pass a comprehensive budget will result in yet another downgrade. We already have the lowest rating in the country. So not so great. Well, stay tuned. We're going to hear in half an hour from Governor Rauner. It's not clear how he'll depict Illinois. We imagine we're already hearing he's going to be very optimistic about the state. In a few minutes, we're going to be getting a preview from IPR State House reporter Brian Mackey, some analysis from political scientist Brian Gaines. But first, we wanted to convene our own little panel on the state of things in Illinois in two areas, social service agencies and K-12 education. Let's start with social service agencies. Wendy Dubow is the president and CEO at the United Way of Metropolitan Chicago. They work with more than 200 partner agencies. We've been talking to her throughout this budget impasse about the impacts on social service. Wendy, welcome back to the 21st.
Nyla, thanks. It's great to be here.
What have agencies been doing, Wendy, since the stopgap funding expired at the beginning of this year?
You know, they've been kind of bunkering down, I would say. You know, I don't think anyone has had any illusions that there would be a budget determined very quickly or very soon. So I think they have been very practical and are continuing to do what they started doing last year, which is cut programs,
lay off
staff, mm-hmm. lay off people. We reported last year, as you know, we've talked about on the show in June, right before the stopgap was created, we actually reported that 1 million clients fell out of service. So all of that was a result of agencies doing what they had to do, which was to cut back programs, in some cases taking out lines of services, in some cases the programs have been cut back, and what has happened is, you know, waiting lists have increased. We've seen some incredible things there with people waiting for intake services and, for example, issues of domestic violence, some of the safety services, people waiting for several months at a time to actually have an intake session. So combination of laying off staff, cutting programs. We see a lot of debt now in the agencies. We reported that as well. Collectively, our agencies back in June had indicated that about 60% of them had completely depleted their cash reserves. About a third of them had taken advantage of lines of credit to keep things going. And back in June, the combined total of the debt of the agencies that we fund was about $40 million.
Okay.
So $40 million. And so, you know, a number of what I would say are real cutting to the bone kind of initiatives. And a lot of concern, you know, all of this also too, as the agencies look forward, as we all look forward, enormous uncertainty about where you go in the future. So the other thing that some of the agencies are doing is saying, wow, we may not be able to provide this service at all anymore. So not just cut back existing programs, but if there is no regular state funding committed, we see many of our biggest and best agencies saying, you know, we may not be able to provide mental health
services.
Well,
and you said, yeah, to that point, Wendy, I mean, what's your sense? I wonder if you can give us an assessment of the social safety net that exists in Illinois and what you think the state of social services is right now.
Yes, thank you for asking that question. So I'm going to give you a couple statistics first, and then I'm going to give you my real gut sense of it. So back in June, the majority of safety net and mental health providers that are United Way agency partners around the state, the majority of them, more than 50%, said that they could not meet the basic needs of the clients that they're serving. And I would say things have, you know, gotten only worse from there in this environment of uncertainty. And now at this point, literally we're in the new year and there's no budget, there's no money flowing, right? So what I will tell you is I think we are absolutely gutting our human services as a state. And so, you know, in addition to all the other issues that you mentioned right before I had a chance to speak, I feel that we as citizens in the state of Illinois have to say, what are we doing to our people? Of course, to our most vulnerable people that rely on the safety net and human services. But, you know, how are we? My opinion is that we are eliminating the state of our civil society, and it It should give us pause, certainly on ethical grounds. People should be aware of this. People should, you know, start to activate and, you know, talk to their congressional leaders and take a look at all of this and say, you know, is this what we think is right for our state? How long can this go on? And then recognize the fact that, you know, without services for our people, you know, what kind of growth opportunities does this give us as a state?
Do you expect Governor Rauner to? Do you expect Governor Rauner to talk about any of this today?
You know, I'm not sure if Human Services is actually going to come up because I'm not sure that there's a solution to it yet. I do know that he has, you know, acknowledged that this is a very big problem. And, you know, has wanted to address this, but we need all of our leaders in Springfield to come together and not only acknowledge it and say that they want to address it, but to do the very basic thing of enacting a budget. And then, you know, enacting a budget is one thing. We don't have a budget as a state. That's in I would say, the most basic sense, the first step of government. But then also to have a long-term view of how you sustainably fund services for people and vulnerable residents is essential. And I think we still don't have a plan or line of sight on that. And so I don't know what's going to come out today. We'll anxiously listen for all of that, but we need all of our government leaders to come together and affect that, or we as people need to start understanding the ramifications and saying, wow, as engaged citizenry, we've got to make this happen.
Wendy Dubow is president and CEO at the United Way of Metropolitan Chicago. Wendy, thanks for being with me.
Oh, my pleasure.
Let's move on to public education, especially with K-12 funding, which has received uninterrupted budget financing these past 2 years. But that doesn't necessarily mean that school districts are getting all of their money. Here to explain more is David Lett. He's a superintendent of the rural Pena Community School District 8. Pena is just southeast of Springfield. Superintendent Lett, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla. It's nice to be back with you.
Now, you all have received funding, but there's one category the state has to reimburse you for, costs for things students have to have. I'm thinking about special education, transportation, subsidized school lunches. Have you gotten, how much money does the state owe you for those sorts of things right now?
Yeah, we're just a shade under $340,000 owed to us by the state. And as you eloquently pointed out, we have been the beneficiaries of having, for the past 2 years, full-year budgets in place for K-12 education. And I credit the legislature and the governor for making that happen the past 2 years. And so, you know, listening to Wendy and in terms of Human Services, it's hard for us to, cry too loudly because we are better than the most as it relates to this budget impasse and budget crisis. But by the same token, my colleagues are more than frustrated by the fact that anything that has been gained in terms of any new funding for K-12 education essentially has been lost to date halfway through the fiscal year and not being paid for what are called mandated categoricals, and you identified those as transportation, special ed, and state reimbursement for the lunch program.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Superintendent Lett. I'd love for you to explain what percentage this is of your budget in terms of how much the state owes you. Again, we're about 15 minutes from Governor Bruce Rauner delivering his State of the State address. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Superintendent Lett, get some analysis as well on what the governor is expected to say. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're about 15, 20 minutes away from Governor Rauner delivering his third State of the State address. Right now, we are talking about what the state of K-12 education is throughout Illinois with David Lent. He's a superintendent of Pena Community Unit School District 8. Pena is just southeast of Springfield. Superintendent Lent, you were just saying before the break, we've heard a lot about this backlog of bills the state has, this backlog of unpaid bills. So the state owes you guys about $350,000. Can you give us a sense how much that it represents in terms of the district's operating budget?
Yeah, our primary operating fund is the education fund, and that represents about 3% of our budget. And people would say that's a relatively small percentage, but it's definitely felt. And if we don't receive, any categorical money, that could quickly move to 6 or 7% of our budget.
Mm. Yesterday, the Illinois State Board of Education recommended that pre-K through 12 funding be increased about 3.5% over 2017 levels. I wonder, as you think about funding, what's your sense of the state of K through 12 education for your district and the state? Are we funding things at a proper level?
Well, I think obviously, we're interested in investing in our children's future and our state's future, and so while 3.5% doesn't seem like a lot, but we know that the state itself is in kind of crisis mode. So, I think as I shared with you earlier, the problem on the educational funding front is we've got to get the distribution of those dollars right, and that's what they've been working on for 6 months in terms of the School Funding Commission to basically come up with a new distribution model. They're looking at a model called evidence-based funding model, and basically Illinois has owned the 50th out of 50 in terms of most inequitable distribution. In other words, the dollars haven't been focused on getting them to the neediest districts. And so we're hopeful that with the commission's work and a new funding formula, that the equity issue can be fixed, and then ultimately, new dollars can be derived through, new revenue streams in the future. But like I said, it's hard for us as a K-12 entity to cry too loud when we hear, the horrific stories about social services and higher ed and what they've suffered through the last 2 years. So I do consider our woes a little bit relative as it relates to, the devastation that some of those other areas have felt.
David Lett is the superintendent of Pena Community Unit School District 8. Superintendent, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla.
As we said, we've just convened our own little State of the State talking about a couple of things. We'll be interested to hear now what Governor Bruce Rauner will be saying, both to us, his constituents, and what message is he going to need to send to Democratic lawmakers that's been locked in this budget standoff with. Joining us for more on this now is Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. He's there in Springfield. Hey, Brian.
Hello, Nyla.
Here in Urbana with me in studio is political scientist Brian Gaines. He's with the University of Illinois Institute for Government and Public Affairs and also teaches at the university. Brian Gaines, thanks for being with me as well.
Glad to be here as Brian number two.
Brian Mackey, let me just start by asking, apart from everything we've been talking about, there was sort of a series of insults and tweets last night involving President Donald Trump, Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner, Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Mayor Emanuel criticized Trump repeatedly in the past. Last night on public television in Chicago, he blasted Governor Rauner. After that, a spokesperson for Governor Rauner called Chicago the murder capital. President Trump tweeted he was going to be sending the feds into Chicago if they didn't get violence under control. Is anybody talking about this morning in the State House and the Capitol, this sort of feud that erupted last night?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is, it dominated some headlines this morning. And so that has people's interest because people love a fight in some ways, in turn, at least people in the media love a fight. A lot of people in the State House are still focused on the big picture down here, which is the financial disaster that has been induced on the state of Illinois by the inability of our state's political leaders to come to an agreement on a state budget.
Right. And of course, all week we've been hearing about this grand budget compromise, a series of bills that Senate leadership, bipartisan, Democratic President John Cullerton, his Republican counterpart, Christine Rodonio, were working on. But word last night, that looks like that's not really coming together, is it?
Well, I mean, the leadership remains hopeful, but whether they can get enough votes on board among the rank and file, particularly on the Republican side, is a question. This program keeps evolving. There had been a minimum wage increase in there. That was taken out yesterday. A bunch of new tax proposals were added. Some were dropped. There had been discussion of a tax on sodas, kind of treating that the way we treat alcohol and tobacco in this state. So you'd tax it at a rate per ounce. That's now out of the proposal, but we would now begin taxing some services such as car repairs, amusement services, which is live entertainment, athletic facilities, things like that. Even laundry and dry cleaning would be taxed under this proposal. So I think that there's a lot of strong opposition to this from various. We saw at a hearing on Tuesday in the Capitol, both organized labor and big business groups coming together to say that there were aspects of this they didn't like. And so there's a lot of people pulling against this particular deal.
So it's important to point out this isn't the budget address. This is the state of the state address. Brian Mackey, Governor Rauner's in an interesting position here because on the one hand, you'd think he'd want to reach out to lawmakers, find a way to underscore this desperate budget situation. But on the other hand, he's presenting the state of state. You've got to think he's thinking about running for reelection. We've seen some reports this morning, some other news media reports about how optimistic he will be. Do you think he's even going to mention the budget?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. Illinois does have this system where there are two separate addresses. And so if he doesn't mention the budget today, then he and his people can say, well, we're saving that. That's going to be about a month from now. Mid-February is the budget address. But I think the question is, Illinois is obviously in a terrible situation from a state government's standpoint. The Moody's Analytics put out a report, the State of Illinois Economic Forecast, earlier this week that was sponsored by the nonpartisan budget arm of the Illinois legislature. And I think the first sentence sums it up pretty well. It says, Illinois is one of the Midwest's weakest links, reflecting both soft job creation and the state's descent into fiscal quicksand. And so I think the question a lot of people have here is the governor going to try and gild the charred cinders of the state's ledgers somehow? Will his speech move towards an end of this budget standoff, or will it be the opening salvo in the 2018 reelection campaign he's expected to wage?
Brian Gaines, obviously elections, that's your area, politics and elections. How do you see Governor Rauner balancing all of this?
It's a very tricky job. It's very, very hard to be strictly optimistic. I think he wants to be a little bit optimistic. Almost all state of the state or State of the Union addresses include some, for someone who's been in power, have some claims of achievements. He's going to talk about energy, the Exelon, the jobs bill, which is either a bold step towards clean jobs and green energy or a corporate bailout, depending on your perspective. But that's one thing he can point to as an achievement. I think he'll talk a little bit about ethics and probably there, rather than claiming victory, say he's continuing the big fight on behalf of the people of Illinois against the entrenched interests. But you can't ignore the budget utterly. The state of the state right now is, as others have said already, fiscal disaster. And it would be better for him if he could say we're on the verge of a bipartisan solution. It seems more like we're in the midst of the usual legislative horse trading, but we're so far from knowing what the details will look like and whether it will pass that he can't really claim victory on that front now.
Well, and also, Brian Gaines, it is interesting. We are, when you look at the reality of what's happening in the state, you talk to social service agencies, you talk to people who work with the most vulnerable in our population, people who look at our credit rating, they talk about how bad it is. But when you look at polling, and I'm thinking in particular of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute poll last fall, when you ask sort of regular people if they think the budget impasse is affecting them, they say, not really. This doesn't have an impact on my life. We just heard K-12 education saying, well, public schools are being funded, maybe not higher ed, but what people care about, public schools, that's going to be much more of an impact them on a day-to-day. Is it easy in a way for Governor Rauner to not talk about the budget situation because maybe a lot of people aren't paying attention?
Well, it's always true that a lot of people aren't paying attention to state politics, and that maybe helps him a little bit. The Simon poll had about a third of the people saying that they'd been affected, and about two-thirds saying that they weren't affected. That's not completely amazing because we haven't had a simple shutdown of state government. What we've had is essentially autopilot. So there have been deep cuts in social services, higher education struggling. But beyond that, spending has continued. This is part of the problem, though. It isn't just that we don't have a budget. It's that the fiscal deficit, the underlying fiscal situation, gets worse and worse. We've had claims of pension reform a couple of times, 2010, 2013. We still haven't solved the pension problem. That means the governor, if he chooses, can essentially take lots of passages out of his last State of the State address and repeat them and again say with his admission, let's get this done. But that gets a little stale if you've said exactly the same thing a year before. And so I think, you know, again, he's in a tough spot because he doesn't want to take all the blame, of course, for the stalemate. But I think he can't pretend that there isn't a stalemate.
Brian Mackey, do you sense that we will see, because that is true. I mean, we are in the exact unfortunate same position regarding pensions in the budget as we were last year. I wonder if you think back to last year, what he said about pensions, are we expecting to see any of that today as well?
I mean, I think that he has been pretty consistent about the things that he wants to happen: property tax freeze, changing state pensions,
term limits.
Right. I mean, the details of what proposals have changed from week to week, sometimes even day to day, of which combination of things are sort of he wants to see done before he'll work on the budget. But the big picture stuff has largely remained the same. And that's been really the heart of the impasse. I had a story earlier this week that there is a big philosophical divide. A lot of people, the governor and a lot of Republicans, like to point at House Speaker Michael Madigan and say that he's protecting special interests or he's just trying to hold on to power. But he has, for decades now, going back at least to the start of his career in the 1970s, been very jealously protective of the legislature's prerogatives. And this idea that a governor comes in and says, I want this list of priorities passed, and then we'll talk about the budget. I think they find that to be a dangerous precedent to set. I talked to legislators who said that. And so you have this big philosophical problem a lot of people have, even if the Senate, it seems like with the grand compromise, quote unquote, that we were talking about, Senate Democratic leader John Cullerton has kind of overcome any objections to that. But of course, something would have to pass both the Senate and the House and be approved by the governor before it would become law.
Well, Brian Gaines, what Brian Mackey's talking about in terms of the philosophical divisions are, I mean, we actually even see with polling that voters are also divided philosophically, not necessarily about how to handle budget versus other priorities, but even people how to fix the budget don't really have a clear, there's not really a clear sense of things. So I guess I just wonder what you see, Brian Gaines, as the political costs of all of this inaction going forward?
The political costs are tricky to specify. This is a governor who wants to get reelected. He has very low approval, but he has the benefit of a foil in the speaker who has even worse approval. In their last this recent election, you could pick about six districts where they essentially went head to head, and the Republicans picked up a few seats, and you could say that Rauner won. But he's still dealing with large Democratic majorities, so it isn't as though he's in the enviable position of Donald Trump, where his own party controls the legislature. There has to be a compromise. He's got to work through a compromise. I think he has to strike a careful balance between saying, I am still after those reforms that I've wanted all along that I know are popular, like redistricting reform and term limits. The people want them. I'm fighting for you people against these entrenched interests in Springfield, but we have made progress. And then list off his set of achievements. And you know, I don't see how he can give a purely optimistic speech, but I think he has to say, I'm working hard on the big troubles, and believe me, I'm going to keep fighting for you.
Brian Mackey, you have 30 seconds to answer. I know you hate it when I ask you this. What are your predictions of how optimistic this speech will be?
Well, I don't really do predictions.
I know.
But I think that if you follow the governor's Twitter account, you'll notice that he has been very sunny on there. And there's an avatar of he and his wife and sort of a loving embrace. So I think he is clearly moving to campaign mode. His $50 million donation to his own campaign funds at the end of last year certainly suggests that. So I think he's going to. It would not surprise me, I'll say, if he did try to put a shine on the things that he has been able to do in state government.
Well, we're just minutes away from hearing what that shine will be. I want to thank Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. Of course, you're going to be hearing more from him later today, his analysis of everything. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Happy to do it.
Thanks also to Brian Gaines, who teaches political science at the University of Illinois, also with the Institute for Government and Public Affairs. Brian Gaines, thanks for being with me as well.
Not a problem.
As we said, we've been talking about what to expect from today's State of the State address. Stay tuned. Governor Rauner is going to be delivering that speech in just a few minutes. Stay with this public media station for full coverage of the governor's remarks and analysis and interviews with legislative leaders after. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.